Hi there, listeners of the Accents podcast on WUKY. My name is Katerina Stoikova. I am the host, and this episode has been brought to you by Accents Publishing, an independent press for brilliant voices. My guest today is writer and researcher, criminologist James B. Wells, the author of a deeply personal and investigative memoir that blends family history, espionage, and spiritual discovery. The title of the book is Because: A CIA Cover-Up and a Son's Odyssey to Find the Father He Never Knew. We have so much to talk about. Take us to the moment that compelled you to begin investigating your father's death in earnest.
I guess it was when I found his letters 26 years after his death. I didn't know the man. He was killed when I was 9, and like any son would, I started reading the letters, actually studying them. And I began to see immediately, even at a young age, he was a very moral, righteous, and religious man. Committed to doing the right thing, obsessed with the truth, even if it was at the detriment of his physical safety or career. And being a criminologist, I quickly realized his words and actions met the definition of a whistleblower. Whistleblowing is the disclosure of information of an employer's practices that are illegitimate, illegal, or immoral to individuals or organizations that can take action. And my father had done this at multiple times during his career. And the first such time he did it was when he was 21 years old, when he was a provost sergeant at the Nuremberg War Crimes in Germany. So he's doing this throughout his career. And then I began to think when he was doing it in Vietnam, especially during his second tour, could he have been making enemies? And almost on a whim, I decided to go to Washington. I decided to accompany my wife to Washington, D.C., on her annual trip there to meet with Kentucky's congressional representative. She's a lobbyist for the apartment industry. That's part of her duties. And the National Archives is just a commuter's drive away, about an hour ride on the metro. On the very first trip to the National Archives, I'm looking at declassified documents that start to expose that what the government told us about my father's death was a lie. And that first trip, which was only a few days, led to 6 more week-long trips at the National Archives. Week-long trips at 4 other archives in the United States, including the Air America Archives at the University of Texas at Dallas. My father was killed on the Air America plane. And 2 months in Vietnam at the archives in Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh City, where the locals still prefer to call it Saigon, where I still found evidence contradicting what our government told us about our father's death. Incredibly, my PhD is in research. All my other degrees are in criminal justice and criminology. Incredibly, I have found corroborating evidence from multiple sources that contradict what the government told us and pretty much lay out what is a likely theory as to what happened to my father and why.
So much research, so much time. I'm gonna ask you one of the last questions I was going to ask, and that is, have you ever regretted starting this journey?
Yes, I have. It's taken a huge toll on my wife and the family. In fact, chapter 13 is titled The Toll, where my wife Brenda gives me hell once again for being obsessed with my father's death and taking so much time away from her and the family. I've often wondered what our life would have been like had I never found the letters. I really have. But then again, I think about what I've gotten out of the letters. I reconnected with the father I never got a chance to know. My dead father actually mentored me to become a better man. We've reconnected in so many ways, spiritual ways as well. My father, when he wrote my mother, and readers can find this out for themselves, he had a unique way of communicating to her and writing her. He wrote her as if she's sitting literally across the table from her. And he would have multiple conversations to her throughout the day. First thing in the morning when he wakes up, midday, late afternoon, right before he went to bed, he'd wake up in the middle of the night and have a conversation with her. And I get caught up in that. And I feel like he's talking with me. And in those letters, he actually left clues for me about what happened to him and why, which have actually panned out to be true, which is incredible.
I'm just as fascinated with your father as with you and with your relationship with him. And you mentioned the O word several times, obsession. You know, in my book, The Poet's Guide to Publishing, I say that there are three elements to the art of writing poetry, and they are instinct, technique, and obsession. And I see all that in you and your lifelong pursuit. One is not able to complete this gargantuan effort without a just as gargantuan obsession.
How true. And I have your book. It's going to help me turn out a poetry collection, I hope.
I'm going to read to you a sentence by writer Hisham Matar. He writes a lot about his father who disappeared, and his book, Anatomy of Disappearance. If you haven't read, you'll love it. The first sentence of that book is, "There are times when my father's absence is as heavy as a child sitting on my chest."
Wow. Yeah. How true. How
Yeah.
true. For a long time, when I started writing the book, I was telling people at the Carnegie Center, in fact, when I first started writing this book under Neil Chechnik's mentorship, I felt the title was going to be postmarked Angels and Demons because the letters have both blessed and cursed my life. My father has cursed my life, but then again, he's blessed it. But it's too close to Dan Brown's Angels and Demons, you know. I mean, plus, I'm very happy with the title we ended up with. But probably for 20 something years, that was the title. I've been working on the book 34 years before it actually appeared in print.
The book reads like a mystery.
You know, I didn't intend on the book coming out that way. I think one reason it did is I'm a professional researcher and I wanted to present the facts to the reader as I discovered them and let them decide for themselves what's the best truth they know. And if you notice in the back of the book, I have over 9,000 words of content notes. My publisher, Millspeak Books, was great, by the way. I wanted to cite all my sources, all the archival documents, all my interviews, and everything. But no, I really didn't intend on it to come out as a mystery, but it very much is. And for the same reason, I didn't intend on it to end on a spiritual theme, which it did. But in Vietnam, we kept experiencing miracles on a daily basis. And get this, you know, the only reason we found the once classified crash site of my father's death, we're interviewing a National Liberation Front veteran who has four American bullet fragments in him, who's familiar with the crash. He said, and he, among others, said, "We didn't shoot it down. We had nothing to do with it. No one would have dared shoot at this plane landing this close to this heavily fortified airport." But he can't even remember exactly where it is. He's 90 something years old. And his wife happens to step out of the house, overhear our conversation, sit down at our table. And she speaks up and says in Vietnamese, "I know where the crash site is." And my interpreter and guides grab me, and we jump in our SUV and take off. And it's only later when I have a Vietnamese friend interpret my video recording. I video recorded all our interviews. He tells me what she said. She says, "I know where the crash site is." And my interpreter says, "You do? How?" "Every time I go by there, I am spooked by ghosts." So, in a way, I sense my father's spirit communicating with me in those letters. And once we find a crash site, the couple at the crash site, they saw my father's Air America plane. It wasn't smoking, it wasn't damaged, it was flying too low, and the book explains why. It flies through the gable of their home, hits a bamboo forest, which is like hitting a brick wall. Hits the ground and burns. But she says, ever since it crashed, she's always sensed spirits there, ghosts there. And when I find a classified crash site, I interview them. It's all in the book. And my siblings come over and we hold an Episcopal burial service there because only less than 40% of my father's remains were recovered from the crash site. And after the a burial service, we have a, I guess, like a wake, a catered meal brought in, and our friends and guides and interpreters and government officials come in, and it's a lovely reception. And as I'm getting ready to leave, the woman who lives there and saw the plane crash into her home grabs me and my interpreter and says, "Before you leave, go to the backyard at the crash site and ask your father's spirit to leave with you. So I did as she asked.
What an incredible moment.
There's so many incredible moments in this book. And, being a research scientist, I know how to be objective, but there were so many miraculous things we experienced that the only possible explanation I could interpret only through my faith.
Yes, you're a scientist. Yes, you aim to be objective. But if you didn't have strong emotion attached to this book, to this research, to this oeuvre, then you wouldn't be able to do it. And you're allowed your emotion.
Yeah. You know what? The Bluegrass Writing Studio helps me in that regard. One reason I decided to get my MFA in creative writing, I knew I would have difficulty writing a creative nonfiction book. Research scientists, how do we write? We write long, complex sentences in third persons for audiences smarter than us, I knew I would have a difficult time. And Bob Johnson, the program director, was my thesis advisor. And he had to work with me very hard. He was very patient. And, he had to remind me constantly, James, tone it down, make it simple. But it worked. And I'm going to give credit to Nancy Jensen. She had the reputation of being one of the toughest professors, but I liked her. I remember one afternoon in the summer residency class, she told us one of the best things a writer can do to establish credibility with the writer is to throw themselves under the bus.
I love it.
That night, I stayed up all night and I wrote the first draft of The Toll, where my wife Brenda gives me hell for being obsessed with my father. And throughout the book, I make myself pretty vulnerable. And I talk about things I'm ashamed of throughout my life. And I talk about how I can never be the man my father was, but I'm learning how to make up for mistakes I've made in the past. So, and in some regard, the book is about being true to yourself. And in this book, it was important to speak, not only speak truth to power, but for me, the author, to be true to myself.
And speaking about you yourself, you have this uncanny background that makes you the perfect person for this investigative work. So it almost makes you predetermined to take on the task. So, how did your background in criminology and criminal justice influence your approach to uncovering the truth?
I broke my mother's heart. After my father's death, our Episcopal priest mentored her and said, "The best thing you can do for your children is to take your husband's insurance money and put your children in the best private college prep schools in the South." She did. And so my sister wanted to become an English literature teacher ever since she was in high school. My brother wanted to become a pediatrician. I didn't know what the hell I wanted to be. In my summers in this prestigious high school, I spent my summers with those who knew my father the best in Southern Ohio, his sister, great uncle. My great uncle was a cabinet maker, and his wife was my mother's aunt. And my father knew them very well. They were very close to my father. And they would tell me stories about my father. And after I graduated from this high school, I wanted to become a cabinet maker. I went to woodworking school at a technical school for 2 years. And after that, I became a foreman of a shop in Atlanta. And when my grand uncle retired, I took over his shop in Southern Ohio, and I love that. And it was good for a while, but we had this horrible recession in the early 80s, late 70s, early 80s. And my Brenda had our first daughter, and to pay the bills, I took a job as a correctional officer at a super maximum security prison, plus worked as a cabinet maker. And then to help pay the bills, I also started Army Reserve while taking classes at Ohio University. I'm doing three things at once, driving all over Southern Ohio. And after I got my degree in criminal justice at Ohio University, we moved back to our home state of Georgia, where I started my master's in criminal justice. And I worked for an architectural and engineering design firm, helping these engineers and architects design jails and prisons. And what was great about that job was I'm learning statistics and research methods, and I'm helping these engineers and architects design the right kind of prison based upon research I'm doing. How many medium security cells do you need? How many maximum security cells do you need? How big of a hospital space do you need? They don't know. So that was a real turn on for me. So after I got my master's, I thought, you know what? I'm going to get a PhD in this. So I ended up getting a PhD in research, measurement, and statistics. And I thought I would go back to work for the A&E firm, but while a graduate teaching assistant, I fell in love with teaching. And I took a job at North Georgia College and State University as a professor teaching research methods, statistics, as well as all the criminal justice courses. And in 1990, was it 95? EKU gave me an offer I couldn't refuse, with a reduced course load to really get involved in research. And the move to Kentucky was really good for both my wife and I. So I was able to help a lot of local, state, and federal agencies with research projects. So it was a good move. Now, did I plan that? No.
I want to ask you about perhapsing. What can you tell me?
In the Bluegrass Writing Studio program, we learned about Maxine Hong Kingston and her award-winning memoir, Warrior Woman, A Girlhood Among Ghosts, which was one of the Time Magazine's top nonfiction books of the 1970s. Maxine Hong Kingston has an essay in that book where she takes a story about her aunt in China that could be written on a matchbook cover. And all she knows is that her aunt committed suicide because she was impregnated by a man other than her husband. And she writes this elaborate story about her aunt. And she used the word perhaps, where she resurrects events and conversations between her aunt and this man. I don't have it in front of me. But, perhaps this is the conversation they had when they first met in the field working. Perhaps this is a conversation he had with her the night he seduced her. And perhaps this is how she yelled in agony and screamed When the villagers came the night she had the baby and tore her house apart when they found out she had had this baby. And that learning about perhapsing validated for me what I had been doing even as a young boy when hearing stories about my father. I would hear stories about my father, and I would resurrect in my head events and conversations he might have had. Now, what Maxine Hong Kingston did was speculative. I take it a step further. I use triangulated research, which I'm using different sources, my father's letters, the results of my archival research, the results of my field research, to resurrect events and conversations, to not present what might have occurred, but what most likely occurred. It's my theory. And if anybody wants to refute it, I welcome evidence that refutes it. I welcome the CIA to come forward with their evidence to contradict what I say in my book. So far, they've turned down all four of my FOIA requests, okay? But I welcome the CIA or anyone else to counter my evidence. I'm presenting a paper on this at the North Georgia Regional Book Fair this Saturday. I call it Perhapsing on Steroids, Going Beyond Speculation to Reason to Inference When Writing Creative Nonfiction.
Would you like to read us a little bit from the book?
This is from chapter one. The title of the chapter is Resurrecting My Father and Me, which could also be a title for the book. It had been a typical warm Georgia September day at Longino Elementary School until two silhouetted figures appeared at Mrs. Webb's fourth grade classroom door and asked her to step into the hallway. Moments later, I was called out of the classroom and escorted to the front of the school. A neighbor, I don't recall who, was waiting for me in her car. I think my brother Orr and sister Kathleen were with her. Perhaps she'd already picked them up at their high school. When we got home, mother was standing in the living room and between sobs told us her father was dead. What few memories I have of my father's death are isolated and disjointed. I don't remember crying, ever. I do remember feeling numb and cheated. I recall our kitchen and dining rooms overwhelmed with homemade dishes from friends and family. Our relatives drove down from Ohio and Illinois. I played touch football in our front yard with friends and cousins, and when I looked up between plays, two of my uncles were watching me and conferring with each other from the corners of their mouths. I remember when government officials in their black suits and white shirts came the day after my father's death and met with our family in our living room. They informed us that my father was a sole passenger on a civilian plane shot down by Vietnamese communist small arms fire. They also told us the Viet Cong killed seven South Vietnamese policemen trying to help my father and the two pilots escape the burning wreckage. In her soft voice, my mother asked for the names and addresses of their family members so she could write them, express her condolences, and thank them for their sacrifice. She never got that information. On the day of my father's funeral, our Episcopal church was so full that people had to stand outside its doors. I looked out the back window of a black limousine to an endless procession of cars, all with their headlights on, slowly snaking their way in single file north on Highway 41. At the Marietta National Cemetery, tens of thousands of identical white polished headstones stood in perfect and perpetual attention, honoring my father as they welcomed home another one of their own. My grandfather, Orr McKinley, a World War I veteran who survived multiple gas and artillery attacks in the 1918-1919 Meuse-Argonne offensive, guided me to the funeral tent with his hand on my shoulder. Our priest sprinkled a handful of earth on our father's coffin as six soldiers slowly lifted the flag off of it. Seven other soldiers in the honor guard fired a salute. I jumped as the three rounds pierced to North Georgia air, as the six soldiers on the two sides of the coffin carefully folded the flag. A squadron of jets suddenly appeared. Their scream was so loud, I held my hands over my ears. When the service was over, two of my teenage female cousins ran up to me, weeping and saying goodbye. Late that same night, on the 11 p.m. news, local Atlanta anchor Tom Brokaw gave a moving television eulogy, interspersed with film clips of our family at the graveside ceremony. When an army officer sharply saluted my father one last time as his flag-draped coffin passed by on its way to its final resting spot, Brokaw told the world, "Jack Wells was a career soldier, but he died a civilian. He was killed when communist guerrillas shot down an American plane over Vietnam, September 27th. These are my only memories of that day, or for that matter, week, month, and year. I don't recall going back to Longino to finish the fourth grade. I have very few memories of the following year. No memories of sadness, no memories of crying, no memories of anything. When my father disappeared, it was as if he had taken years of my childhood with him. 50 years later, I reconnected with four of my fourth grade classmates. After traveling from my home in Lexington, Kentucky to College Park, Georgia, I reunited over dinner with Susan Allen Norton, Johnny Marie McDade, Mary Beth Nolan, and Rebecca Mulligan. I lovingly refer to them now as the Longino girls. They told me I never returned to Mrs. Webb's class after that day. They remembered how upset they were with never having had an opportunity to express their condolences and say goodbye. They recalled how traumatic that event was and how I seemed to disappear and die just like my father did. After my father's death, my next school memory is from a different class on the other side of Atlanta, but I'm not sure when that happened. To confirm what really occurred, I obtained my archived Longino transcripts, including my assessments, test scores, and teacher comments from grades 1 to 4. Comments from first to third grade included, "Jamie did very good work in the first grade. He is a pleasure to have in the classroom. Jamie is a good student. Talks too much until he finds out you mean business. Is well liked by others." The sole comment from my fourth grade teacher is, "It has been a difficult year for Jamie. He can do excellent work when he concentrates." My school records indicated that I returned to Longino and finished the fourth grade there, not across town. The emotional truth must be that after my father's death, so much of me was missing, even my classmates couldn't recognize me.
Wow, James.
You know what's incredible? At one of my author events, it was at the church, the Episcopal Church in our hometown, College Park, Georgia, where I was raised. Rebecca Mulligan, one of the Longino girls, was there, and she still swears, "I never returned after my father's death."
Wow.
You know, she still can't believe that I actually did. Isn't that crazy?
That is crazy. Well,
I was a ghost of my former self.
yeah, it definitely is an event that breaks life in before and forever after.
Yeah, I know it.
Let me ask you now about your book tour because it's in progress and it is something that we can all learn from. The way that you approached it and the way that you're conducting it right now? Tell us about it.
Well, first of all, it's a lot of work just to prepare for it. To help save money on travel expense, well, we're kind of fortunate. My wife and I retired last year, and so we bought a small Class B RV. This is the smallest RV you can buy. It's like a van, and you can park it in a regular parking place, but it's long. We wanted something small enough to navigate city traffic and park near a bookstore, but it actually sleeps four, believe it or not. But we got a good, really good deal on it. We bought it last year, and right after the book launch at Joseph Beth on Father's Day weekend, we started our book tour. We've hit all the highlights in Kentucky. I think a dozen different bookstores and places in Kentucky. We after that doing that, we went to my father's hometown in Medford, Ohio, and that was well attended. It was really great to go there and see people who knew my father. And then we went to Georgia and did, I think, four events in Georgia, which was great. And what helped in Georgia was Suzanne Van Atten, the book critic for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, did a review of Because. At first, she was going to put it in her Tuesday column, but after reading the book, she and her editor decided to make it the feature story on Father's Day. So it was on the front page of their special inside living arts and living section. So everywhere we went in Georgia, there were people who had read the paper, believe it or not, showing up, which was great. And get this, at one of these events, I met somebody when I was a graduate teaching assistant at Georgia State. I had my master's working on my PhD, and this kid was in my class. He remembered me. He's now a retired attorney, but he showed up. His name was Fred Bailey, but it was great meeting somebody that I'd known, what, over 40 years ago. But I really liked what Suzanne Van Atten said. She said, here's one sentence. In the course of his research, Wells made some damning discoveries. Most alarming is the fact that the day Jack Wells died, he was scheduled to implement a national program to reduce corruption in the refugee corruption pro settlement operation and to correct the headcount, which is, you'll learn more about that in the book.
You attempted to connect with veterans. What do veterans think of the book?
They've been great. I've visited several VFWs and American Legions. The Vietnam Veterans of Association of America did a review. Here's one sentence from it. In some sense, then, this book also is about a journey back in time to discover the truth about a father's death and forward in time to a type of reunion of the father with his son. This meticulously researched and documented book deserves high praise. That's great coming from Vietnam Veterans of America, because one concern I had was my father was pretty critical of the US Army, how they were fighting the war. But I also made it clear in the book, he didn't blame the grunts, the soldiers. He blamed the high brass, the generals and the ambassador, but still, I was concerned how they might take it. But I think everywhere I've gone, and I've met hundreds of veterans, Vietnam War veterans, they all realize, I think, now it was a mistake. We shouldn't have been there, So it's gratifying that my father knew, one of the first to know, we shouldn't have been there. And This first letters from 1962 reveal he was a whistleblower. Daniel Ellsberg, by the way, my father and Daniel Ellsberg were in the same province at the same time, working for the same agency in 1965. Daniel Ellsberg didn't blow the whistle till he stole the Pentagon Papers, which was, I don't know, 68 or 69, I think. I can't remember.
What does your wife think of the book?
You know, any other woman would have left me. I truly believe that. She's been highly supportive. She's read the book. She's actually reading it again. She's read the book multiple times. She likes the book. Sections of it still make both of us cry, to tell you the truth. But she's got mixed feelings about it. And when you read that chapter 13, The Toll, you realize why. In fact, my wife is very eloquent when she's angry. And those words of her in chapter 13, those are her words. My father stole time from her, and she talks about she's come to love him and she's come to hate him.
If your father could read your book, what do you think he would say?
Thanks, son. I'd like to think it. He's at peace.